The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
My husband and I listen to your show all the time, and we just love it.
Love your show.
I think you're a wonderful combination of information, humor, and faith. I just really appreciate you being on the air.
It's a beautiful day.
I know the night is late. But when we come back, our very first bill will repeal the funding for 87,000 new hires.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Did you see this story? Now that they the Chinese now want herd immunity? Yeah. No, after locking away their citizens, total chaos, you know, people starving in high rises, the Chinese have decided now they think herd immunity is best. Not making it up, folks. We'll get into that in just a little bit. Hope you had a great weekend. Telephone number 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. The Eagles have clinched the NFC East. It's official now. That's over. And the Cowboys go down in defeat yesterday, on top of all of that, to the Washington Commanders, which is equally hilarious. So everything just feels great. DeMar Hamlin recovering, enjoying his Bills on to victory yesterday in a pretty devastating fashion. So the NFL season continues to be interesting if you're a fan. Ray Didinger, who is the greatest analyst in the NFL, as far as I'm concerned, joins us at 8:30 to talk about that. And it's Law Enforcement Appreciation Day today, too. So we have a couple of law enforcement favorites here to talk about the state of law enforcement today. And just as an aside, not really anything to do with it, but we haven't really dived too deep in this wacko that murders four people in Idaho and then heads for the Poconos, because, of course, the Poconos. Our buddy Rob O'Donnell lives not far, actually, from there. He lives up in the northeast of the Commonwealth. And so I've got lots of questions for him about that. We didn't really talk about it last week, but as they extradite him from Pennsylvania, send him back to Idaho, the investigation and how they did it. You know, for a while, people were confident that this was not being run well, this investigation, because we weren't hearing things. And I had no opinion because I'm not in law enforcement or investigations, so I don't know. I mean, of course, when somebody murders four people in cold blood, you want answers and you want them quickly. And I guess in the heat and eat, grab and go, 24/7 cable news cycle in which we live, people expect that you would find that guy who murders four people, like, yesterday. Well, pretty painstaking work to finally find the guy. And the fact is, he's crossing almost the entirety of the continent in a car with his dad and heads to the Poconos, and that they catch him in Monroe County. I mean, that's actually stunning that we have the technological ability to do that. I can't wait to hear some more details on that. So we're going to get into that a little bit today. Okay, I know, folks, I've heard from you, and I know that some of you are mad or dissatisfied or whatever about the outcome of the final vote to make California Kevin the next Speaker of the House of Representatives. And all I can tell you about this is, if you were of the opinion or impression that Kevin McCarthy was not going to be Speaker, I don't know who gave you that impression. I hope it wasn't me. Fast Eddie, did I leave anybody with the impression that Kevin McCarthy wasn't going to be Speaker of the House?
No, Chris, you were honestly my barometer because I was getting really amped up and I'm just like, oh, they're going to do it. They're going to stop. And you're like, ah, that, take it easy. So, no, you've been very fair on this.
Well, yeah, I just didn't. I was thinking about it based on some of your reactions. You know, if you're a Harumph Society member, you already know kind of my thoughts about this, generally speaking. And I think on balance, given what we have to deal with and given the and folks, I have to say this again, I'm not trying to be a wet blanket here, but let's not lose ourselves. We only control the House of Representatives and barely. So it's not like, you know, he was, you know, Kevin McCarthy's the one. If only we could correct that, then it's smooth sailing. No, we still have the geriatric old fossil we're pretending is president in the White House. We still have the ambulance chaser over in the Senate, and sorry to bring this up, but they've picked up a couple. You know, one of them, the guy that can't speak from Pennsylvania. So we don't have a lot of cards to play. So what was that fight about, really? For those of you who were under the impression that that was about removing Kevin McCarthy, and I want to kind of walk that out for a second because I don't know that we could have made Lauren Boebert the Speaker of the House, folks. It wouldn't. What does that mean, ultimately? And if you answer that question honestly, what you'll find is it means that there would be a lot of maybe oversight, but that's about it. Nothing goes from there. So I don't care how aggressive this Congress gets. Again, I'm not trying to depress you here. I'm just trying to be honest. It doesn't matter how effective and how ruthless and how tough they get, there's very little they can do outside of what McCarthy has already promised, and that is the power of the purse. Hold things up. Hold funding up. And that's not bad. If that's the best we can do, that's big. Like I told you once upon a time that I remember the late, great Justice Scalia in a dinner speech that I was fortunate enough to attend at the Union League in Philadelphia. He said one night, and it stuck with me because it's not the way I think of it today, naturally, and I think it's not the way most of us think of it today. He said, you know, in a three co-equal branches of government situation in which we were founded, it used to be that the executive and the judiciary were ferociously jealous of the legislative, ferociously jealous, because they were always seen as the ones with the most power. And that might, I don't know about you, but to me that landed funny because since I've been paying attention to politics in the modern era, would you say that Congress is the branch that comes off as the most powerful? I mean, in the last, let's call it 20 years. I mean, just since 9/11. What branch of government has gotten more powerful and what branch of government has become less powerful and less effective? Or what branch is? And I think you would have to say beyond a shadow of a doubt, when we debate branches of government these days, when our heads are on fire about issues, when media is going wall to wall with subjects, what's it always about? Is it about Congress? I mean, oh, we get spending debates and, ooh, potential shutdowns at the end of the year, which are never shutdowns and are always rubber stamping huge spending bills. So it's, yes, we get that. But I'm talking about substantive, like, meaty stuff that the country roils and fights about. When was the last time it was about something coming out of Congress? Obamacare comes to mind as maybe one. But to my memory, correct me if I'm wrong, over the last certainly 10 to 15 years that I've been doing this show, we've been talking about executive orders, executive action. We've been talking about judicial reviews. We've been talking about judges. We've been talking about appeals courts. We've been talking about the Supreme Court ruling, overturning Roe versus Wade. And so, in other words, the judiciary and the executive, with absolutely no legislative authority whatsoever, have now become central in our lives. And this is the problem. This is what that fight was about, folks. It wasn't about Kevin McCarthy, the man. It wasn't about removing Kevin McCarthy, and it wasn't about installing somebody less Kevin McCarthy-esque into the post. This was about oversight. This was about restoring some, and I'm not saying it's perfect, and I'm not saying I guarantee they're going to do it, and I'm not going to say at the end of 2 years you're going to walk away feeling really satisfied. I don't know that. You may not. I can't promise that. I'm not telling you that's for sure going to happen. Spending cuts have been negotiated, rules to make it harder to raise spending, taxes, the debt limit, seats for Freedom Caucus members on key committees. Any one member can force a motion to vacate. Any one member can move forward to toss California Kevin if he gets crossways with them. You've been hearing this term church-style committee. I'm not sure a lot of people even know what that is. Now, again, if you're a Harumph Society member, you would already know. You would have seen this video of Frank Church, an Idaho senator back in the 70s, considered one of the most left-wing Democrats in the Congress at the time. What is a church-style committee? In fact, Fast Eddie, there's a video I posted at the Harumph Society a couple of weeks ago. It's a couple minutes long of him on Meet the Press. I think it was 48 years ago, talking about the power of the surveillance state in this country and how it must be guarded against. This was back in 75. Frank Church led one of the most important oversight investigations ever undertaken by Congress into covert operations by the United States intelligence community. 1975, this month back in 75, the Senate voted 82-4 to form the United States Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities. Do you know what came out of this? I had to educate myself. Maybe you already know. I didn't know this. One of the things that came out of this, interestingly, ironically, the FISA Court. The FISA Court was created here. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, requiring intelligence agencies to submit requests for search warrants to a special federal court and obtain court permission before initiating surveillance on American citizens. Now, what's interesting about that? You see, the surveillance state always finds a way. So something really meaty and important came out of Congress in the surveillance state. Oversight of the surveillance state. And it was the FISA Court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But what we know about that is the intelligence agencies have now figured out, well, in order to get a warrant to spy on our fellow Americans, we'll just completely lie to them. We'll just completely misrepresent the goods that we have on our fellow Americans. We'll trick FISA courts into issuing warrants to allow us to. So this is why oversight is needed. And this church-style committee that's been called for, that's what that is. It's not a religious institution committee. Some people don't. It was created in response to explosive revelations of the United States Army's program of domestic surveillance. And an article published in the New York Times on December 22, 1974, written by Seymour Hersh, exposing assassination attempts on foreign officials by the CIA, the committee launched a series of investigations into American intelligence agencies. Church representing Idaho in the Senate from 57 to 81, a key figure on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His willingness to investigate the intelligence community, which often put him at odds with his own Democrat Party. Ha ha. Sound familiar? And his experience serving as an intelligence officer in the Army during World War II made him the ideal candidate to chair this bipartisan committee. Texas Republican Senator John Tower was made vice chair per Church's request. Can you imagine a liberal Democrat in Congress today, sitting with a Republican and together co-chairing a committee to get to the bottom. And this, ironically, just like in the 70s, Senator Church was opposed by his Democrat pals to dig too deeply into what the government was doing in spying on fellow citizens. So this is one of the concessions that was enacted. Did you find that video, Fast Eddie? You know, you didn't find, oh, I got to send you the link there. It's everywhere. I've got it here. Okay. Well, I'll get to it in a minute then. Let's listen to some of the audio from the weekend, the reaction to this. Eyepatch McCain, Dan Crenshaw, reacting to 15 rounds of voting before we get to California, Kevin.
They are the enemies now, an unsparing description of the Republican holdouts from Texas Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw, a conservative who spent the speaker's fight directing his fury at many of the never Kevin Republican hardliners. Does Congressman Crenshaw still believe his House colleagues are acting like terrorists? Can he work with them to govern? Congressman Dan Crenshaw joins me now. Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Let's take a listen to what Speaker McCarthy had to say about the path forward for House Republicans after he was elected early Saturday morning.
And I think by having the disruption now, really built the trust with one another and learned how to work together.
Was that your takeaway, that it really built the trust with one another and learned how to work together?
I actually do agree with that.
You do?
More than I disagree with it. You opened up with the whole terrorist comments. So I do have to address that.
Please.
Things get heated and things get said. Obviously, to the people who took offense by that, it's pretty obvious that it's meant as a turn of phrase. It's a metaphor. It's in the context of intransient negotiations. I've got pretty thick skin. I'm called awful, vile things by the very same wing of the party that I'm fighting. I was fighting at that moment, so I was a little taken aback by the
sensitivity.
Yeah, by the sensitivity of it. But to the extent that I had colleagues that were offended by it, I sincerely apologize to them. I don't want them to think I actually believe they're terrorists. It's clearly a turn of phrase that you use in what is an intransient negotiation. It's important to note the reason that, the 200 were so upset was because we felt we had already come to the agreement that we have now. This was not new. We had this stuff. And early on in that week, before we take
I don't want to listen to this guy anymore because he irritates me. What a smug, sanctimonious little prick this guy. Eyepatch McCain, I'm done with him. This is one of the most smug people. If smug had a picture in the dictionary, it's the guy with the eye patch. That even his haughty kind of derisive tone. Yeah, well, obviously it's a turn of phrase. It's a metaphor. To the context that any of my colleagues were into. No, your colleagues are secondary. It's we, the people, who were pissed off that you were suggesting that those of us who wanted this push were somehow. It's this suggestion that conflict. Healthy conflict inside government's a bad thing, and that we shall shut up, fall in line, and rubber stamp. That pissed us off. That's insulting. But if I had colleagues that were offended by it, I sincerely apologize to them. And then, of course, he always did this straw man thing. I love the straw man. I mean, I was shocked that anybody was upset by my calling them names because, I'm called so many names. The same wing's calling me. Who's called you names? Which Republican member of Congress has called you names, Mr. Crenshaw? I will pay $100 to anyone who can provide evidence that a single member of the House of Representatives has called their colleague Dan Crenshaw a name. I'll give you $100 if you can produce it, because I'm confident I'm going to keep it in my pocket. I can't. All right, here's the Frank Church video that I was talking about. This is, folks, again, I want to remind you, this is 48 years ago, this senator from Idaho. Listen.
But let me tell you this. In the need to develop a capacity to know what potential enemies are doing, the United States government has perfected a technological capability that enables us to monitor the messages that go through the air. These messages are between ships at sea. They could be between units, military units in the field. We have a very extensive capability of intercepting messages wherever they may be in the airwaves. Now, that is necessary and important to the United States as we look abroad at enemies or potential enemies. We must know. At the same time, that capability at any time could be turned around on the American people. And no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know. Such is the capability of this technology. Now, why is this investigation important? I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to see this country ever go across the bridge. I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America. And we must see to it that this agency and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision, so that we never cross over that abyss. That's the abyss from which there is no return.
So that, folks, is prescient speech from an Idaho senator, a liberal Democrat from 48 years ago. And so born out of this fight with Republicans in the House was something they're calling a church-style committee. So when you hear church-style committee, they mean Frank Church, that guy you just heard. Reading from Anna Paulina Luna, one of the Republican who posted over the weekend what the specifics were in terms of concessions they got from McCarthy, a church-style committee, which allows us to look into the weaponization of organizations like the FBI against the American people. So we'll see. Now we wait. Now, again, I know a lot of you are ticked. There's no good SOB. It's Kevin McCarthy. We got screwed again. Look, if you're of the mindset that all is lost, and that because Kevin McCarthy is speaker, that this was a loss. If that's your point of view, I can't talk you out of it. I'm not going to try. I'm not trying to sell you on why Kevin McCarthy's a swell guy you should trust. That's not my position. It wasn't before this fight began. It wasn't during the fight, and it's not going to be now. I say we have to see. But I am pleased on its face that these 20 people held together and exacted very specific things that they wanted from him. Now we watch and see if they can achieve it. But I remind you that there's only so much that these people can do without a Senate and an executive branch. So you want this to be as toothy as possible. A Jeffersonian motion to vacate the chair. This allows a single person to make the motion to remove a speaker if he goes back on his word or policy agenda. So these people will rear their head again, they say, if McCarthy gets sideways with them. Term limit vote. There will be a straight up or down vote on term limits, something he did not want to do and something most of these people don't want to do. Listen, I have explained to you before, not that this is hard to understand, but some people say, what's the objection to term limits, or why wouldn't people support term limits? Well, it's not just about a government check and being in power. I mean, a lot of it's that, but it's not just that. The reason a lot of people oppose term limits is because if you hang around Congress long enough, folks, you become more powerful. It becomes very difficult to ascend to Speaker of the House, for instance, if that's your career trajectory. If you're just elected a freshman this year and you have goals and ambitions in mind about where you'd like to go politically, you want to climb the ladder in Congress, you want to work the back halls, you want to do the fundraising, make the calls, you get a committee assignment, climb the ladder, maybe become speaker, very House of Cards political drama. That's real. You know what makes that hard? Term limits. You can't ever really amass big time power in the House of Representatives if you're term limited. And that's, for some people, if I'm to be wholly honest with you, there are people in the Republican Party as well as the Democrat Party that have problems with term limits, not just because they want a guaranteed government paycheck, but because They know that that limits their ability to amass a lot of power quickly. In order to climb the food chain of the House and sit on a committee assignment, particularly chair a committee when your party's in power, you can't work the halls of government if, you know, you're held to 6 years. So that's one of the big oppositions to that. But there will be a term limit vote now. Single subject bills can't be loaded with irrelevant nonsense. Single subject bills. How remarkably refreshing if they actually do that is this. So when they vote it on something, it's literally just that thing. It's not also tucked in there is funding for Planned Parenthood and all that crap that they do. Also tucked in there is $5 trillion for the pallid sturgeon. What? I thought we were voting on roads. So single subject bills, a Texas border plan. I don't know what that means. More details to follow. A budget that stops an increase in the debt ceiling and holds the Senate accountable. Ending emergency funding and all COVID mandates and funding. Great. 72 hours. Once a bill is produced for them to vote on, they have 72 hours to read it. That's a guarantee they exacted out of McCarthy. These are things McCarthy wasn't willing to do on his own or hadn't thought to do on his own, but agreed because of this group of 20. Folks, this is a good start. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not promising you it's going to happen. But if you were ever under the impression that Kevin McCarthy wasn't going to become speaker, I'm sorry that you feel betrayed or misled or bummed out, but I was never of the opinion that McCarthy wasn't going to be the guy. I was of the opinion that this guy was going to have to work and hustle and make his case that he was somebody that they could trust. I mean, the truth of the matter is, while I think they could have come up with a new consensus candidate if McCarthy resigned, McCarthy wasn't resigning. And as long as McCarthy didn't quit, you had 200 plus members who weren't going to bail on him. So it was incumbent on the smaller group to figure out how to exact concessions from him. There clearly was not going to be a candidate while McCarthy was in the fight that could emerge. This would have had to have gone on and on and on and on until McCarthy just finally said, okay, for the good of the country and for the good of Congress, I'll step aside and put away my professional ambitions of my entire adult life. I'll set all those aside for the good of the Congress. That was never going to happen. And so you may think McCarthy's a scumbag who has a lot of personal ambition and you think it's gross. Okay, I hear it. That's fine. But the point is, he was never going to get out of the way. So there was never going to be a consensus candidate that was going to emerge until he did. So the best you could hope for were these 20 people to exact these concessions, and they did. I think. We'll see. I don't trust him, you shout. I don't either. You're correct. You shouldn't. Trust but verify. So we wait. The point is, for the first time in a long time, some faction of opposition in our party rose up, held things up, made things uncomfortable, exacted some very specific concessions that I think should make us happy. And again, to the extent that we control much of anything, which we don't, we control one half of one third of government. Not a lot. That's right. I say we control only one half of one third. Hence why you're so mad, by the way. I'm also mindful of that. I explained last week, McCarthy was your pinata. We were the stick. He was the pinata. We're ticked at the way the party has continued to govern itself and lose and lose and lose and lose. So this little modicum, this little shred, this little window of power that the Republicans have in the House, you want to make it count. Well, I think these 20 ensured that it will, at least to the best of their ability. So I look at it as a net positive. I see these 15 rounds of votes as a win. And by the way, you know, when I read people like Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer mad, that tells me it's a good thing. He writes this entire piece today about the tyranny of the minority. Can you believe this? Will Bunch is a guy for those of you who don't know him, he is, I call him panties in a bunch, left-wing lunatic. He hates. He's written a whole column. Supposedly he hates the powerful, but really that's not true. How minority rule could implode U.S. democracy in 2023. One of these days, the dam is going to break, he says. I believe there will come a time when Americans wake up to the reality of minority rule and say enough is enough. Huh? We're a representative republic, Mr. Bunch. We have a government that was literally constructed to protect the rights of the minority. I thought you people were all about protecting the rights of minorities. Just not, I guess, when it comes to the Republican Party. I see. So anyway, all the right people are upset, which tells me it was a good day.
I saw the fire in your eyes. I saw the fire when I look into your eyes. You tell me things you want to try. I know temptation is the devil in disguise. You risk it all to feel alive.
By the way, I should point out, this is, you know, from many different outlets. This particular read is from National Review, but many outlets reporting this. Kevin McCarthy thanked former President Donald Trump early Saturday morning for helping him finally secure a win in the 15th round of voting for House speakership. I do want to especially thank President Trump, McCarthy told reporters. I don't think anybody should doubt his influence. He was with me from the beginning. He was all in. So I say with all the love and respect that I have in me here, that those of you who are enthusiasts of Donald Trump's should know that Donald Trump was 100% enthusiastic about Kevin McCarthy. And most of the, you know, most outspoken pro-McCarthy people, like your Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, were all saying that Trump was the guy that made this thing happen for McCarthy, ultimately. You can make of that what you want. I'm not editorializing. I'm offering that up as that's what they're saying. He would call me, and he would call others. He really was. I was just talking to him tonight, helping get those final votes, McCarthy said. What he's really saying, really, for the party and the country, that we have to come together. We have to focus on the economy. We've got to focus, make our borders secure. We got to do much work. He was a great influence to make all that happen. So thank you, President Trump. Trump on Truth Social said it's time for our great country, Republican House members, to vote for Kevin, close the deal, take the victory, watch crazy Nancy Pelosi fly home to a very broken California, the only speaker in U.S. history to have lost the House twice. Boebert suggested on the House floor last week, as you know, that Trump should tell McCarthy, sir, you don't have the votes. It's time to withdraw. And of course, he didn't. Trump responding to McCarthy on Saturday saying, thank you, Kevin. It was my great honor. The speaker selection process, as crazy as it may seem, has made it all much bigger and more important than if done the more conventional way. Congratulations to Kevin McCarthy and our great Republican Party. No, it's funny, people that aren't regular listeners making conversation with me about this at church yesterday. A couple guys came up to me and said, can you believe this thing on the, like, it, you can tell it takes the wind out of their sails when they come up to me. They want me to get mad with them about it. Can you believe these Republicans fighting about Kevin McCarthy? Can you believe it? And I go, I can believe it, and I think it's fantastic. Huh? Now, I mean, that is one interesting thing. As someone who is mindful that the rest of the country is not you and me, and there's a good chunk of the country that's not paying as close of attention as you and I are to these things. They don't live in it every day like you and I do. There is the possibility, and I'm not saying that right now we should concern ourselves with it, and I don't think it's going to be long-lasting, but I bet if you polled it, it would not be surprising if polls came out on this fight to say that even amongst Republicans, a good chunk of Republicans found this distasteful. It wouldn't surprise me. I haven't seen any polling on it. I'm kind of surprised we didn't, frankly. Maybe probably because it was over too fast. There wasn't enough time. But if this had spilled into, say, like a second week, you probably would have started seeing polling to pressure the Republicans. I mean, because these were some conservative people. I went to dinner with people on Friday night who had no time for this. Couldn't believe it. Furious that this was going on. Ran to some people at church. What are these Republicans up to? And however, a guy did stop me at church, and he acknowledged it. He said, Chris, I'm not telling you this story as a bat pack. I'm not. I'm going somewhere with it. Guy stopped me, and he said, I want to thank you for the things you were saying about this speaker fight. I said, oh, well, I think I was just articulating what most everyone listening was feeling, at least based on the things that I was reading. And he said, no, you were. He said, but I know that it was tough out there on you to take those positions. And I said, I appreciate that. I didn't feel tough, but I know what he meant in this. I did, and I sent some messages to some friends of mine as the week wore on last week, and I said, I'm starting to feel like an island. It's starting to feel kind of lonely out there, and I don't mind it. I've been there before. I'm just sensitive to it. And when I start to look around at all my colleagues, people with whom I like, I trust, I respect, I listen to, I'm mindful of their thoughts on these things, I don't typically find that I stray too far off the reservation from where most of them are in terms of, and I don't mean just thinking alike like lemmings for the sake of singing from the same hymnal. That's not what I mean. I mean, ideologically, there's some people out there that I respect that I'm typically not. It's not like I'm checking to see what they're saying about something. I just find that when I do check in, they're like, yeah, okay, they see it the way I see it. Okay, good. But when I started looking around and I found just about everybody in mainstream media at the national level who identifies as a conservative, all opposed to the Republicans fighting McCarthy, I did. I started to feel quite a bit like an island. And, you know, such is life, not whining to you about it, just letting you know that I'm well aware that, and I'll remember. I will remember names. I will remember who stood where during this fight. I'll just put it to you that way. Five Senate Democrats who could retire ahead of next year. This, as I said in my New Year's greeting at the Harumph Society, this ultimately is what makes me happy when the calendar turns. We're 1 year closer to Senate elections. We're 1 year closer to a presidential election. And that's what's exciting. This is a bit of a lame duck year, if you will, because you're going to have a lot of senators running for the tall grass. And they've identified a handful, five of them, that they think are already sort of anticipating maybe in trouble or too big a fight for them to be able to wage. They're just not interested in having the fight anymore. Democrat Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Democrat Senator from Montana, John Tester. Democrat Senator from Virginia, Tim Kaine. Democrat Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. And finally, and by the way, we wish him well. I guess he announced last week that he is battling prostate cancer. I guess they caught it, maybe early stages. Hopefully it's all going to be just fine. But what about Bob Casey, Senator from Pennsylvania, Democrat? Casey's announcement Thursday, he was recently diagnosed with prostate cancer, left many wondering what that might mean for him past 2024. In a statement, he said he had an excellent prognosis. Prostate cancer is highly treatable, men, if we catch it early, which is why you should always test yourself for it when you get to be of a certain age. The son of Pennsylvania's governor, former governor, Robert Casey Sr., three-term incumbent Casey, won out two of three races by double digits. After Republicans lost the Pennsylvania Senate race in November in a matchup between Fetterman and Oz, members of the party will be looking for an opportunity to regain a seat in the Keystone State. Dave McCormick, who narrowly lost the GOP primary to Oz last year in Pennsylvania, reportedly considering another Senate run in 2024. That's according to Bloomberg News. I can confirm that, too. McCormick wants another swing at that. And he thinks Casey's the race to play. Is Casey more vulnerable now than he used to be? I think he knows he is. And I don't think he's made of the stuff to fight. I think he was used to dining out on his last name. And I think those days are gone. I'm not even sure he can weather an intra-party fight. quite frankly. So isn't it interesting that even though you may feel really dispirited as a conservative out there, look at the Democrat senators who are likely to just hang it up and call it a day. West Virginia, Montana, Wisconsin, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of the five, you could argue that Pennsylvania's gone more blue lately. I don't think all is lost there. Again, I think it's a strategic problem in Pennsylvania. I don't think that conservatives and Republican voters just evaporated. Again, we have a ballot collection problem. And as long as the next Republican Party chairperson, Harmeet Dillon, hello, and not Ronna Romney McDaniel, coming up at the end of the month, as long as the Pennsylvania Party officials do not help coronate Ronna Romney McDaniel again, and we get a new strategy as to how to collect ballots in Pennsylvania as opposed to turn out the vote on Election Day, I still think Republican votes in Pennsylvania matter. So I'm not willing to dismiss Pennsylvania as gone and blue and never to be won again. I don't think that's true. But Virginia, Tim Kaine, this is a guy that Granny Crooked Hacker chose as her vice president. You'd be forgiven if you forgot that. What a forgettable campaign. Throwing her lifeless corpse in the back of a van, her shoe falling off at the 9/11 tribute. Remember that? Good grief. She's a terrible, unlikable woman. Coughing constantly, calling voters names. And then she picks this schlub Tim Kaine from Virginia as her veep. You'd forget that. I bet you 9 out of 10 people don't even remember that guy's name. So, and, you know, you got Glenn Youngkin and the epicenter of the school choice fight in Virginia. Tim Kaine doesn't want any of it. Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, another one. I'm not sure. These are going to be nasty fights, to be sure. And there's going to be a lot of money. But Manchin and Tester, West Virginia, Montana, those are two, I think, that are pretty likely Republican pickups. So the Senate is looking much more favorable for Republicans in 2024, just as a practical matter. And then, of course, you got Grandpa who's pretending he's going to run again. Who knows for sure? So, look, I'm looking forward to this session of the House, this 118th House of Representatives session. I think good things can come from it, and we wait for 2024 and what looks to be a much more positive year for Republicans in picking up the Senate. So imagine a even if the Republican candidate for president doesn't take out Gramps, which I can't imagine, but even if that doesn't happen, imagine a Republican-controlled Congress. And that's something. I'm thinking incrementally here, folks. I'm not going to try to eat the elephant all at a time, just one bite at a time.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Chris, good morning. Love your show. You and Eddie are the dynamic duo.
I have a very hard time finding any news source that I can trust, so I'm very grateful to have this listen to on the way to work.
If I can halt for a second and just say to you, the impact of what happened on July the 6th had international repercussions beyond what I think any of you can fully understand.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Great to have you here today. Hope you had a fabulous weekend. Welcome in. Telephone number 610-850-0990. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. I didn't spend time on this last week. We were far too busy. And it's not that I found it unimportant. I typically don't do crime stories. It's Law Enforcement Appreciation Day, though, and I thought it would be a fitting conversation to have with our buddy Rob O'Donnell, who we appreciate anyway, a retired NYPD detective. I was interested in it and that it was a fascinating story of law enforcement success. I know Rob was all over it, but it was something we just didn't have time to dive into the specifics. But being that it's Law Enforcement Appreciation Day, Detective, first of all, Rob, welcome to the show. And thank you for all your years of tireless service in law enforcement. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chris.
You betcha. How do you view your career? in law enforcement now that you've stepped away from it? Do you look back on it fondly?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love the job. It's just the circus I don't miss.
And what do you say to people, I've asked you this before, to people today who might think about a career in law enforcement? Do you encourage it, or do you tell them to run from it?
It's tough. In certain municipalities, in certain cities, you know, I say, you know, don't do it. But there are places in America that do appreciate their law enforcement, do support their law enforcement, and I would encourage you to seek those places out.
Yeah. LawEnforcementToday.com is where you can find Rob's work. While I have you today, I thought it would be kind of interesting to comb through the particulars of this murder in Idaho, because it was something that I think early on people were frustrated in the 24-hour news cycle. We want answers, and we want them yesterday. And people thought that, I don't know, maybe there was some bad behavior or sloppy behavior or Keystone Coppery going on out in Idaho as they were investigating these murders. People just couldn't grasp that you wouldn't have a guy detained in relatively short order after a grisly murder of four people. But I didn't say that. I just heard people being critical. Ultimately, it took some time. But what they ended up doing in finding this guy, having crossed the country with his dad in a car all the way to the Poconos in Pennsylvania, it's really astounding. And it speaks to how sophisticated the work is, that it does take time. But it's nothing short of miraculous, frankly, that you could find a guy all that way away from the murder scene.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the police departments in that area, the Moscow police, the state police and the FBI did an extremely well job here. You know, I understand there is a public interest in these stories. You know, there was someone on the loose that did murder four people. I understand that they want to be kept in the loop, but these investigations are never supposed to happen in the public eye. You know, but there's an unreasonable expectation from the public. They want to see these things solved in 45 minutes without commercials. And that's just not the way crimes work. And when you look at it in hindsight, and I knew this was going on behind the scenes, there was just incredible work, incredible police and investigative work here.
This guy sounds like what he was. There was an interview last week I saw on Fox News that maybe he reached out, or his professor reached out to the BTK, the blind torture kill murder guy in Kansas from years ago, that he has obviously a real fascination with this, that he had been a student of how to pull off a crime like this. Is that what we're to understand about this guy?
Yeah, I dove into that a little bit. And where that's coming from is the BTK's daughter's daughter is the one who brought up this theory. And that's all it is at this point. She believes, based on the type of crime, the similarities, and the fact that Kohlberger, Brian Kohlberger, who lived in Pennsylvania, studied under a professor that made the BTK killer her life's work. So she believes that he may have reached out to her father, but she has no evidence of that at this time.
And that guy, just as a historical reference, he, if you want, I mean, I hate to use the word successful, but I mean, he committed murders over years without, decades, right? Without ever being caught.
Yeah, I believe he has somewhere between 8 and 10 and over that time, the victims.
But what I hear from people who know this stuff, that this guy, if he fancied himself some sort of brilliant student of murder and how to commit the perfect crime, he didn't do so. He did it pretty poorly, actually.
Yeah, just like anything else, you know, you could be as great as you want to be academically, but unless you're actually doing it in anything, not just this, not that you should go out and practice this stuff. But, I think he thinks he's the smartest person in the room, and that's going to be his downfall. The crime scene was sloppy. He did make mistakes. We do have his DNA, you know, the tracking, even though he attempted to mask his tracking by shutting off his phone during the times of the murders. That's going to be his downfall, him believing he's the smartest person in the room.
This guy traveling cross country at this time, I guess, when you're investigating this stuff and he's with his dad, do you, as an investigator, do you assume that the family knows or doesn't know? Do you have to treat the family as kind of innocent bystanders caught up in something? Or do you have to act like, well, maybe dad could know what's going on? How do you treat that?
You just keep an open mind about it. I mean, even him, until they had the DNA evidence, I mean, they kind of suspected Brian Kohberger, but until they had that solid DNA evidence, which they didn't get the match until he was in Pennsylvania on December 27th, and then they made the rest of the arrest on December 30th. So within 3 days, they processed the DNA that was obtained from the garbage in Pennsylvania. They had the conclusive evidence for probable cause for an arrest, and that's when they moved in. So you have suspicions, you keep an open mind, and you let the evidence, you know, direct you.
That's amazing. And that's one of the ways they did this. Is it true that they were using one of those DNA test kits that people are, you know, 23andMe kind of stuff?
No, that was actually all false when it was brought out. They found DNA on the K-bar knife sheath on the button that they couldn't match to anything, but it was DNA from no one in the house. And then after they followed him to Pennsylvania, they ended up collecting the garbage that was discarded, which is totally legal. It's discarded property, and matched it to the father. And it was a 99.99% match that the father, you know, the son was the DNA that was taken from the knife sheath at the crime scene.
Wow. How did they know that this guy, I mean, how do you, when you're there at a crime scene, how do you, and you find DNA that's not the four murder victims, where do you start looking? That always, I mean, how, that's needle in a haystack stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you put it in a database for anyone whose DNA is on file. But like in situations like this where he's never been arrested, there's no DNA on file. You know, they had no match, but based on all the other evidence, some of it circumstantial, of the pictures with the vehicle, him changing his vehicle registration 5 days after the murder from Pennsylvania to Washington State, the cell phone tracking, the fact that they have him surveilling the house 12 times all the way back until August of last year. And his cell phone pinging him, you know, putting him, and the shutting off of his cell phone during the time of the murder. And now you have the roommate, the surviving roommate, who did come face to face with him, and has, you know, even though he was masked and clad all in black, you know, she did point out that, you know, his height, his body structure, and that he had bushy eyebrows. And one of the first things the police noticed when they pulled his driver's license after the University of Washington police identified his vehicles was these bushy eyebrows. So even a physical description that matched. So they had a lot of evidence pointing to him, which is why they were monitoring him and looking at him. But once they got that solid DNA evidence is when they moved into the arrest.
How about while he's driving cross country from Idaho to Pennsylvania, he's pulled over twice for what, speeding or something, right?
Yeah, I think he was tailgating at one point and then speeding at another point. This is something that doesn't surprise me. I mean, even the fact that he was just pulled over, but the fact that it was arranged by the FBI. You know, I've done surveillance. I've been in narcotics. I've been in organized crime and the homicide task force. You know, we commonly ask local uniformed police to pull over, you know, look for a violation so you could pull them over so we could reset assets. You know.
Oh, so this was on purpose. This wasn't a fluke. Sorry to interrupt, Rob. This was not a fluke. Law enforcement was asked to look for him.
Well, they didn't look for him. They were asked specifically to pull the car over because the surveilling units wanted to get body cam footage of him to see if he had any cuts or anything on his hands, okay, to see what was in the vehicle, and probably to reset assets because they probably had three or four vehicles following him at any given time. So, you know, you don't want to be around them too much to tip them off. So sometimes assets get either too far ahead or too far behind, and you have to reset them. So you tell local authorities, you just can't pull anybody over for no reason. So, hey, wait till you see a violation. It's not too hard to see somebody do something wrong while they're driving, changing lanes without a blinker, you know, driving too close, so they can reset the assets and get ready to keep following.
What if, while he was detained in Monroe County, I heard that he was asking questions like, was anyone else arrested, and that kind of thing. And the things he says in general while in custody, right? Anything you say can and will be used against you. Apparently he was yapping quite a bit.
Yeah, again, I think it goes back to him thinking he's the smartest person in the room, and he's thinking ahead, creating doubt. You know, at this point, there's no evidence that shows there was a second party. But him, with his educational background in criminology, knows he says something like that, it could create doubt in the trial later with the jury. It will create doubt in the investigators that are following. So I think it's something he purposely put out there just to purposely create doubt that probably doesn't exist.
It's just, it's an amazing story. And one that, as I heard it, I thought to myself, this is a question. Sorry if it sounds macabre or whatever. It seems to me that in 2023, it would be almost impossible. I mean, if you're a pretty devious person and you decide, I really want to kill, it seems like it's a pretty tough thing to get away with and getting increasingly tougher to get away with. True?
Oh, it does. I mean, our investigative tactics are getting better. Technology that we all use, you know, everyone should be aware of the tracking ability of that. And that seems to be the real downfall. Video evidence across this whole, across two states, actually, from his campus in Washington State, which is only about 10 miles from the University of Idaho, and his cell phone pinging, which, you know, 8 days after this murder, I put out a series of tweets on November 21st. It was right after the autopsy was posted, basically laying out exactly what the authorities did. And it's amazing how dead on it was.
Yeah, they knew what that's what's so unfortunate is, and I know they can't really listen to it. Media made it out to sound like, what are they doing? What are they up to? They like they were, you know, clowns. In fact, they weren't. I mean, they were surgeons. They were doing everything above board.
Yeah, they looked at thousands of cameras across the area of these campuses to get pictures of that white Elantra. They did a search of 22,000 vehicles in the Northeast. And what it turned out is a University of Washington police officer who had the bulletin to look out for this white Elantra and said, you know, let me check the campus parking records. And they found this one registered to Pennsylvania. And when they went to go see it, it had Washington plates, because one of the key features was that the car didn't have a front license plate. They didn't have any license plate, but they knew it didn't have a front license plate, which we all know in Pennsylvania is indicative of our vehicle registrations. But in Washington and Idaho, there are two-plate states. So, and then to see that he changed his license plate, he matched the description, and that's when they started getting, you know, the subpoenas to get his cell phone records, and they started checking thousands of cameras in the Washington and Idaho area, seeing this car going back and forth. And once they had the cell phone records showing that he was in front of this house at least 12 times before the murder, he was seen, the car was seen three or four times the night of the murder right in front of the house, and then seen speeding away right after the murder took place at a high rate of speed. You know, all this put together just puts an excellent case down. But there were thousands upon thousands of pieces of evidence that these officers were looking at.
Amazing. That is amazing detective work. And there is no evidence whatsoever to suggest this guy knew these four people that he killed at all.
The father of Kaylee Conclaves said that there will be something that comes out. Now, you have to understand, the evidence that's out there now in this probable cause warrant, this is just enough evidence to say, hey, we have enough to arrest him. We have probable cause to arrest him. That DNA match and all the circumstantial evidence about the vehicle videos and the cell phone information. But more information will be out there. The father of one of the victims says that a link will come out later in this case. So, you know, we'll have to see.
And the burglary charge is interesting, too. You guys in law enforcement, you very specifically charge for certain reasons. What was the, and somebody explained this and I missed it, or at least didn't fully understand it. The burglary charge is important, right, when you're prosecuting a case like this?
Yeah, it's charging him from entering the vehicle with the intent to commit another crime. So that's I mean, obviously the murders are the other crime, but to enter, you know, a home or a business with the intent to commit another crime is the key factor, because it shows, you know, the reason he entered that house was premeditated intention.
So, but because if you didn't do that, then what? Right? There's a reason. I mean, if you don't charge that, if you just charge murder, technicalities, you could get hung up in court with other things, makes it less, not likely, but makes it increasingly likely for, if you want to call it a mistrial or whatever.
Yeah, well, not that. I mean, just because there is evidence out there that this was a party house, and, you know, if the defense tries to say that he was invited in, he had a right to be in, he was in, welcomed, you know, then maybe it's not murder, maybe it's a manslaughter, maybe it was a crime of passion or something like that. So okay, the fact that they charged the burglary showing he entered that house unwanted with the intent to commit another crime, you know, highlights that this is a first-degree murder.
Wow. This is the kind of stuff that I also hear that guys who do detective work, which you did, if you all had every case go national like this, it would be far more helpful. I heard a guy say, you know, they're not all national cases. So, you know, when they are, that's great because you get bombarded with tips. But so many of these you never hear about.
Yeah. I mean, again, this was in the public eye. It was a national story. And they did take a beating for the time, but these things take time, you know, putting all this type of evidence. And if you look at the evidence in its totality, it's just amazing they put it together in that short amount of time. The fact that they did dive deep. I mean, I think the arresting investigator, the corporal, you know, only has 4 or 5 years as a police officer. They did extraordinary work.
Rob O'Donnell is a retired NYPD detective himself, senior national law enforcement contributor for Law Enforcement Today. Rob, it was great to catch up with you today. Thanks for the we didn't talk about this at all, so it was good to have your expertise on it to kind of give us the full 30,000-foot view. So thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
No problem, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Join me weekday mornings at 11 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
There's a story at Breitbart that I wanted to call your attention to. Headline, Pro-Trans Group Explains How They Embed Gender Ideology in Schools. It's authored by somebody called Spencer Lindquist. Transgender organization explaining how they use children's books to embed gender ideology in schools and get in front of kids. A video from the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network sheds light on how the organization seeks to embed the ideology in America's schools. Michael Rady runs the organization's Rainbow Library program, explained that they send LGBTQ plus affirming books to schools and libraries for free, and some of those books are even aimed at kindergartners. We talked to you about the American Girl doll people who had books in their stores for a time. I guess they've since been taken down or taken offline, as I understand it. I can't confirm that, but they were caught or called out telling little girls, maybe if you don't feel like a girl, you don't have to be a girl. The American Girl doll store people were involved in this stuff. So this is real. This is what these school board fights all across the country have been about. I sat in a school board meeting where a woman who was a candidate for school board, quite literally after 30 years of teaching, said, I won't get involved in deciding as a school board member what a book will be offered in the library. That's why we hire librarians. They're trained professionals. This is real. This culture fight is very real. Lest anybody try to convince you it's not or that it's made up. So real, in fact, that Ryan Bomberger, who's co-founder and chief executive officer of an organization called the Radiance Foundation, is countering in their own way with a brand new offering of children's books called She Is She, sheisshe.com. And Ryan joins us now. Mr. Bomberger, thanks for your time today and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's great to be here with you.
This isn't made up. I think some people might be inclined to kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, the you wackos. There you go. Making something out of nothing. This isn't a thing. No, this is a thing, and it's happening even in the smallest rural school districts across the country.
Absolutely. I actually live in one of those. I actually live in Loudoun County, Virginia. You may have heard of Loudoun County.
Yes, the epicenter.
Yes. Yes, ground zero for, you know, school boards going wild. And this is exactly what we're dealing with the total erasure of gender. And this is brought largely by, you know, left school board members that are introducing books. They call them diversity books, but they really are perversity books because they show explicit sexual activity. I mean, they promote pedophilia. I mean, this is going on in rural schools here all throughout America, and people don't realize. And it's not just about the erasure of girls and women. It's about the erasure of objective truths.
And yes, objective truth, biblical truth, this is something that we talk about in church. This is something that my pastor believes needs to be discussed and talked about right now. And he's not shying away from it. And this issue of, no, boys are boys and girls are girls, that God doesn't make mistakes. I mean, if you're a Christian and you allow people to start convincing our children that, maybe God screwed up or that gender's malleable, I don't think you can call yourself a Christian anymore. I really don't. Not a Bible believer, anyway.
And it seems weird to have to say Bible-believing or biblically adherent Christian. I mean, that should go hand in hand. If you're Christ-like, then that's something that you embrace without question. And we know, you know, God created us male and female, and from that is that his expression manifest in us as human beings. And it's a beautiful thing, but for Christians to even deny it, and for anyone to even deny that this is going on, and we got people, you know, teachers here in Virginia who have been fired because they used the wrong pronoun. One of my friends, Tanner Cross, was fired immediately after speaking in a school board meeting saying he loved his students too much to call a boy a girl and a girl a boy. And this is the man who was a physical education teacher. He knows a little bit about biology. So it's this insanity that we are all being forced to actually not only deny basic biology, but mangle our language in order to accommodate a really confused and chaotic worldview.
Ryan Bomberger, the book, the very specific book is called SheIsShe.com, and I want to talk about the book specifically in a minute, but can you tell me about the Radiance Foundation generally?
Yes, the Radiance Foundation is a nonprofit organization that my amazing wife, Bethany, and I co-founded about 14 years ago now, and it's based on the belief that, I shouldn't even say belief, it's the truth that every human life has God-given purpose. You know, I'm from a family of 15. I was adopted. 10 of us in our family were adopted.
So wow.
Really passionate about adoption. Yes, in fact, I'm that 1% that's used 100% of the time to justify abortion. I was conceived in rape, but I was adopted in love. And I thank my courageous birth mom for not only giving me the gift of life, but the gift of adoption. My wife was a single mom in her 20s as a teacher and faced all that. And had that beautiful baby beautifully transform her life. And that baby girl's name is Radiance. She's our oldest daughter. I was able to adopt her when she was 5. And she's the reason for the name of our organization. So we love illuminating that no matter the circumstances, planned, unplanned, able, disabled, every human life has God-given purpose.
What an amazing story. I don't want to detract too much from your project here, but I'm just curious, given what you just said, your birth mother gives you up for adoption. You're adopted into a huge, loving family, obviously. Have you spoken to your birth mother? Have you ever met her since?
I have not. And I did pursue trying to find out who she was. And unfortunately, the pursuit, I'd had my adoption records unsealed. The pursuit ended up without any response. But I'm just so grateful for it. And as a creative professional, I've tried to figure out ways to express that gratitude, whether in a song or I have a video that's called Life is Purpose that just shows all the things I've been able to become in my life by the grace of God because of her singular decision.
And
so that's why we're such advocates for life. I mean, the things that we erase, the people that we erase, the possibilities that we erase when we embrace the violence of abortion, it's just so tragic.
And your wife, if I heard you correctly, she had Radiance prior to your meeting her, and you adopted Radiance?
Yes, my wife was a single mom. She was a teacher in the Philadelphia school district, and yeah, and you know, she had all kinds of, you know, colleagues tell her just abort it, and they didn't realize that baby girl already had a name and already had a destiny. And I just thank God that my wife chose to be courageous and rejected the violence of abortion. And of course she is too. She never considered abortion, but the pressure on her, people telling her you can't be a professional, you can't be a teacher, you can't continue in your career. And she did. And now she's a homeschooling mama of 4. She's the she's the executive director of the Radiance Foundation. And having that beautiful baby girl did not end her life. It actually strengthened her to be a better individual. She'll say that to anyone.
Wow. Wow. And as for you, one of 15, your adoptive parents, your parents, they adopted how many children altogether, you and how many others?
Well, they had 3 homemade ones first, and then they adopted 10 of us. I was the first one adopted. And yeah, 10 of us, white, black, I'm mixed, white and black, Native American, Vietnamese, able, disabled, and they loved us all like crazy. They shattered that whole myth of the unwanted child.
How do you all get along, out of curiosity?
Mostly well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's 13. They're 13 kids, and inevitably there are going to be some fights. I have to admit that I instigated most of them. But we do get along. As adults, we get along great. We love each other. We support each other. I will say that I do have several siblings that I'm continuing to pray will embrace Jesus as their Savior.
Yep.
And that's what's keeping them from flourishing. I will say that. But many of us are serving the Lord, and it's really amazing to see what love unleashed in our family.
I think that is one of the most notable and amazing thing. I happen to know of a couple who took someone in as well and ultimately fostered. I don't know that they fully adopted, but this was a very troubled child who wasn't really able to assimilate with their, as you say, homemade kids, and ended up needing to seek out of the home special treatment. And that's tough. So, you know, adoption is remarkable and selfless and sometimes doesn't end happily or is a perpetual struggle. But it's still to the people that do it, I don't think any of them would say it's not worth doing, even so.
Oh, and I'm an adoptive father. I have four kiddos and two of my kids were adopted as well. So it's definitely worth all of it. And what I find funny, people have this mentality that, you know, you don't know what you get with adopted children. You don't know their past and all that. Well, actually, a lot of times you do know their past. But I didn't get the memo that your biological children are easy to raise.
No.
I must have missed that memo.
I'll say amen to that.
I mean, that's just life. And pouring yourself into just transforming a narrative of brokenness into wholeness is a powerful thing. And in the natural and supernatural, that's what adoption does.
What a remarkable story. I'm glad that you shared this as an aside. Radiance.life is that website. Radiance.life if you want to read more about Ryan Bomberger and the Radiance Foundation. Now, specifically the book, She Is She, and you can get this book at sheisshe.com. This is a children's geared book, yes?
Absolutely. It's a beautifully illustrated children's book that's primarily targeting kids 2 to about 8, but it's also for kids even older. My wife was a middle school teacher, and they would do picture books even in middle school, 7th and 8th grade. But it's primarily for ages 2 to 8. And it really just counters this gender spectrum propaganda that's out there. And it's this denial of what being a female is. And so it really just celebrates, you know, beautiful, undeniable, biological her.
And your wife is a homeschooler, homeschool mom now, is that right?
She is, among many other things. She's an international public speaker / homeschooler /. There are a lot of slashes there. But she's also, this is her second book. Her first book was Pro-Life Kids, another illustrated book teaching children an age-appropriate pro-life worldview. But this book we co-authored together, She Is She, and it really just, it just celebrates what it means to be female. There aren't these boundaries to what it means, what you can achieve. And it also really focuses on family. We celebrate adoption through it. We celebrate the beauty that pregnancy is. In fact, there's a scene there where a woman's in the doctor's office and they're confirming the gender of the child, which we know before birth. And so there's a lot that's poured into this book. And it's age appropriate, by the way. The world always loves to throw all kinds of slime at young children. It's age appropriate. But what we do have at sheisshe.com are further resources so that if a teen or an adult want to dig deeper, that there are more resources to help bring more context and clarity to this confusion that's happening in our culture.
What a lovely story you tell beyond your project, which I love and I can't wait to learn more about. But I just, boy, I appreciate your personal testimony and witness and goodness. You're clearly a light in a very dark time, you and your wife both. So Ryan Bomberger, thank you for your time today. The Radiance Foundation is found at radiance.life. The book that he was just talking about is called She Is She, and that's at sheisshe.com. I hope we'll talk again, Ryan, but I wish you and your wife the best and a Happy New Year to you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Happy New Year.
Don't hurt me.
I didn't get to this last week, but I thought it was interesting. The Philadelphia public school system is temporarily returning to mandatory masking. And as such, as school was reconvening, two city schools were hit with anti-mask graffiti. It's come to that. Messages of "let the kids breathe," "no masks," and "kids don't wear your mask" were painted on sidewalks around two South Philadelphia K-8 schools. Police investigating the incidents. Superintendent announcing in December students and staff would pivot back to mandatory masking now through the 13th of January as a post-winter break precautionary measure. Meanwhile, in China, China's communist leaders, this from PJ Media, have jettisoned their goal of zero COVID for a not-so-new approach, herd immunity. After 3 years of brutal lockdowns, including welding people into their homes, the Chinese are now pressuring people to contract COVID. Not kidding. The change came in December after massive protests in November. The Chinese government then reversed course, decided herd immunity was the way to go, and the number of COVID cases has since exploded. China now believes 248 million people, 18% of the population, have been infected in the first 20 days of December, with 37 million people contracting COVID in a single day. So basically, the CCP is adopting a totally different strategy compared to the zero COVID policy. They now seem to want to encourage people to get infected to develop herd immunity. That's according to a U.S. Army virologist. I mean, it would be kind of funny and ironic and ha ha ha, except we did the exact same thing here. That's literally what we did to ourselves. Candace Cameron Bure, remember her? The sister of Kirk Cameron, DJ Tanner on Full House. She was in a lot of those Hallmark movies for a very long time, and then she decided she was going to start her own network, something called the Great American Family Network. And she said, when asked, are you guys going to do like gay marriage themes and stuff like that? She goes, no, not really. This is going to be a Bible-based network, so no. Not, those are unwelcome, and you people will burn in hell. She didn't say anything. She just said, no, we're not going to be doing gay stuff on the Great American Family Network. Well, she was savaged by all of her colleagues in media, by, I guess, even co-stars of her show, like longtime friends and co-stars, people that worked alongside her in Full House and Fuller House on Netflix. But like everything else, you know, attacked by the left, all that ends up doing is amplifying the work and making it more popular than ever before. It will come as no surprise to you that it's exploding in popularity, this Great American Family Network. It became the fastest growing network in all of cable TV, as a matter of fact. She posted last week to Instagram, the closing fourth quarter of the network is the fastest growing network in all of cable. Thank you for finding and watching the Great American Family channel. In a tweet from the network, they shared great news, Great American Family to end 2022 and an even better way to start 2023. The press release, the network shared that in only the channel's second year, it ranked number one in total day ratings growth in households ages 18 to 49 and total viewership. It also noted the network came in number one in primetime ratings growth in households among all cable networks. There's a lot of cable networks, folks. The press release said that the jump in growth was a direct result of the network's Great American Christmas franchise, which featured 18 original Christmas movies that included Bure, among other fan favorites, Danica McKellar, Gladys Knight, and more. She recently shared what kind of Christmas programming fans could expect from the network that planned to go head-to-head with Hallmark during the holidays. She left Hallmark to join Great American Family to tell what she called faith-filled stories, as previously reported. You know, I couldn't help but notice over the weekend, too. And I say this with delight. Suddenly, the National Football League and all of the people that cover the National Football League are big-time believers. I'm glad to hear it. I hope they continue to comport themselves as such. This DeMar Hamlin story has got everybody on bended knee and praying and talking about the beauty and the power of Christ. And I'm grateful. I'm sincere. I think it's wonderful. I thought it was wonderful the night that he dropped after having a heart attack. You had both players and the whole stadium silent. You had people on ESPN openly praying. Look, DeMar Hamlin himself, recovering in the hospital, shared a game day message for his team just hours before they were set to play the New England Patriots in their first game. That's my quarterback, Hamlin tweeted, sharing a video where he said, God is using me in a different way. Game day, nothing I want more than to be running out of that tunnel with my brothers, but God is using me in a different way. Tell someone you love them today. Lots of faith-filled messages, I will say, on your NFL screens over the weekend. I'm sure you noticed that. That's a great thing, incidentally. Then there's this. I don't know if you saw this from Axios or not, but it shouldn't surprise you. Here's the opposite. 12th graders. Is this census data? No, I don't know where it comes from. It's from Axios. But anyway, it's percentage of 12th graders, seniors in high school. And this is from 1976 to 2016. So we're not even talking current. The data they have is only up to 2016. And we're talking about high schoolers now, seniors, 12th graders. Percentage who have gotten a driver's license has dropped from 1976 to today, 84% to 72%. 84% back in the 70s to 72% in 2016. Now, you can imagine that's dropped even further. So all these numbers I'm giving you, this is 2016. So imagine over 6 years, it's dropped even further. Percentage who've tried alcohol. This is a good development, I guess. 81% in the 70s, down to 66% at present. And even lower now, you would imagine. Gone on a date. 83% in the 70s, down to 58% at 2016. So you can bet that's now down to half. And then worked for pay. Worked for pay. 71% of high school seniors in the 70s worked for pay. Down to 55% as of 2016 of high school seniors. And you can imagine that's dropped. So about half. The study also says that female teenagers are more anxious and depressed, and they credit it all to social media. Get them back in church, my friends. That's the point.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
WNTP, Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
I absolutely love your show.
Chris, greetings from the bright lights of Cherry Hill.
We don't have a crisis of lawlessness. We don't have a crisis of crime. We don't have a crisis of violence. And that is a category that includes gun violence, but it also includes some pretty horrible stuff, like rape committed without a weapon, or like a stabbing.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Philadelphia police fanning out to some of the city's most violent areas starting today. The Philadelphia Police Department will disperse more than 100 officers in four different districts to cover North Philadelphia, Kensington, and the Tioga-Nicetown area. John McNesby is a friend of the show, president FOP Lodge 5, and joins us on this Law Enforcement Appreciation Day. Mr. McNesby, to you and all the men and women you represent, we do appreciate you and we welcome you in. Good morning.
Appreciate that. Good morning.
Yes, sir. Talk to me about the recruitment effort, because I saw last week on Fox and Friends in the morning, I saw some of your officers were there on national television inviting folks to come. It sounds like a lot of larger cities are now. In fact, I read a report that D.C. was here in Philadelphia doing some recruiting. True. Is that it's kind of in New York? You guys are all kind of I don't want to say warring. I'm sure it's a friendly rivalry amongst one another.
Well, it's every man for themselves. We need cops in the city of Philadelphia. We're down, I think, probably 1,000 to 1,200 officers comfortably. Wow. Is what we need. And I think we're all drawing from the same pool. So, we're out there trying to do that. I'm increasing the budget with the city for recruitment to make sure that we get out there and we're able to attract the best possible people. But I think there's some tweaks that we have to do inside, too, to be able to keep the people and to be able to, I think, one of the things, we got a cop out there running, the pretest or an applicant, and they missed a run by, say, 7 to 10 seconds. I mean, you're knocking them off the list for that. You know, put them in the academy and let them work 8-9 months to get that 7 to 10 seconds. And if they can't do it by then, shame on them. But, you know, some of the rules are antiquated. We need to adjust them, and we need to bring the best people in, because we gotta have backup out there, and we have to keep the community safe.
What is the process from start to finish? I mean, I know you can't walk us through literally everything, but yeah, what should people understand if they're
frame, they're going to go in, they're going to fill the, you're going to apply online, then they'll go to a pretest with a reading test and physical agility. Then they'll move on to a physical itself, and then a background investigation at the same time, as well as a psychiatric and a lie detector test. So the whole process probably takes about 4 to 6 months if they're moving and everything's all the stars align. Then you would go into the academy. But right now we have, you know, once you get into the academy, it's a 10-month process. And during that time, we're losing 10 people to 15 people a month. So, you know, whatever they're putting in, we're just treading water now. So we need to get class after class for the next year, year and a half in there to be able to just be where we need to be.
John, is that early retirement or people just walking away from the job?
I think, you know, when other places were, you know, when COVID came, every place continued to recruit except for here. You know, we got into a bedwetting frenzy here, and everything shut down and masks, and other places were still doing what they needed to do to recruit law enforcement. And I think that helped with the deficit now. That and, you know, people are, it's just a perfect storm. We had a lot of people whose retirements were up from 25, 30 years ago, and they just decided to leave and move on to another position. I mean, who would want to stay with this illustrious district attorney that we have and the leadership in Philadelphia? I mean, I would.
Do you guys take comments from people considering or entering, or I mean, do you have a sense of why people do or don't enlist?
I think a lot of it is family. I think a lot of them have law enforcement backgrounds in their family, military backgrounds, and they look forward to continuing on, you know, with that family, you know, with that family gene in them, I guess, so to say. But that's mostly, and you know, some people just come off right out of college with you know, degrees in criminal justice. They decide to go into the field. It's a good paying position here in Philadelphia. The benefits are the best in the country. I could say that. And, you know, things, you know, it has its ups and downs, obviously, which any job has. But it really is a good good position.
What if somebody would care to jump in, is there a career path or trajectory? I mean, can you climb? I mean, if somebody was, you know, aspiring to maybe become an officer or, you know, administrative, what's the process there? Can you think of it that way or no?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you can come on. You're going to start in patrol. You're going to push a car for a few years. And then obviously people like to, you know, you have your group of people that study. They have study groups. They move on to detective, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, et cetera. Other people look to do specialty jobs like forensics or crime scene or different units like that, accident investigation. And then you have the people that just like to just drive a car for 20, 25 years that they're content doing that. So there's a lot of different avenues once you get your foot in the door to move up, and there's room to move around also.
Is the need specifically for men and women to patrol, as you say, in the car, or can you apply and do other work?
No, you can, once you get in there and you get some background and you get some experience, you can apply for different positions. You can go to narcotics, you can go to highway patrol, you can go to the mounted division. There's a lot of different divisions within the department. With you know, every one of them right now has needs. So, but the biggest need right now is patrol, because when people are out there and they're dialing 911, it's probably one of the most tragic or important times of their lives. And right now, nobody's coming because of the lack of personnel out there.
Wow. You have to be 21, I assume.
Yes, 21. You have to, you have a year to move into the city of Philadelphia. You have to have a driver's license, clean background, and job history. So it's a lot of different moving parts, but I think it's well worth trying it.
JoinPhillyPD.com is the website. JoinPhillyPD.com. $20,000 hiring bonus right now, too. Is that right?
No, not 20. I wish it was. That's D.C.
D.C.'s doing that. I'm sorry. That's that's right.
It's
sorry.
Probably,
excuse me.
It's probably $10,000 a month to live in D.C. But here you would. I think it's right now we're at 3,000, and then are all officers also. We just were able to successfully with the administration be able to get them a retention bonus to stay here. Because what happens was a lot of these outside suburban departments were cherry picking our cops. We'd put them in, we'd train them, we'd pay for the training, and then they'd come and take them. So now we have a little retention bonus just for them to stick around and stay in Philadelphia for at least 5 years.
20 grand. That's an astounding sum of money. Why are they, I mean, what is D.C., are they having a bigger problem with recruitment than you guys?
You know what? I don't know. They don't have as big of a department. I know every department, every major department is short. But I could tell you the cost of living in and around Washington, D.C. is probably triple what we have here. So maybe that's why it's much higher. And, you know, $20,000, like you just said, it catches somebody's eye. And, you know, it intrigues them. Then maybe they go out there and they fill the paperwork out and see what happens. But, you know, right now, Philadelphia, I think, is the place to be. Again, we have the best, great starting pay. We have the best benefits in the country. And we're getting a little money from people to come on. So, you know, we've got to weather the storm with some of the things that are going on now. But I think, you know, you could see the light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully they take that job application and they fill it out.
John, how important is that residency requirement to you? Is that something that you would like to see go away, or is that important, do you think?
No, I think we fought for that. We fought for residency once the officer, and we won. Once they have 5 years on the job, they can move to outside, you know, suburban areas, just like every other profession. But to move in was kind of, you know, I can't see, you know, they were stopping everybody unless you were a resident of Philadelphia for a year from filling out an application. And that's just backwards. Nobody's going to move to Philadelphia hoping to get a job. You know, they're going to secure a position, then move to Philadelphia. So you had to flip it around and give them a year to move in, which is more sensible, and it just makes complete sense doing it that way.
Yeah. Well, look, I hope I maybe a corner is turned. Do you think it is it the politics of the day, the crime of the day, the sense that if I go do this job, I don't have the backing? Do you think that's what hampers your recruitment efforts?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I think they know that they don't have the backing. They're going to go out there. They want you, you know, it's like holding the door and telling you where the problem is. Go in there and fix it. And then if you stumble, then you're going to get screwed. So I think that's big. You know, people worry about their futures. They worry about being prosecuted here, especially with this district attorney that we have now. It seems the only one he is arresting is Philadelphia police. So, you know, you got to be careful. But I think, you know, using your head and good supervision out there, you're not going to have to, you know, that's not going to be a big stumbling block. But that and the second thing is, it's not a really, you know, people these days, it's this generation doesn't seem to be that attractive to police work. Or seem to, you know, feel that that's an attractive position. So we have to change that mindset, and we have to change it quickly.
John McNesby is president of FOP Lodge 5. I know this is politics and not necessarily your wheelhouse, but where do you think things end up with the Krasner impeachment fight in Harrisburg? Would you like to see that proceed?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be awesome if that, but we were able to get that done. I know that there was a stumbling block right before the holidays where they said they couldn't move forward with the impeachment. I don't know whether, and they're supposed to make a decision this week, whether or not to appeal that to the Supreme Court. But I think, I mean, you know, a year or two ago, this was just us screaming about this guy and his lack of caring for the, you know, for the city and for victims of crimes. Now everybody seems to be getting a piece of that because it's affecting them, not just in certain neighborhoods, it's across the whole city. He has just that attitude where he don't care. So we need to change that. We need to get somebody in there and put somebody in there. I mean, he was elected to do a job, and right now he's not doing it.
There was a story that just kind of piqued my interest. I think it's probably just gossip and not likely, but it was just interesting to me that Michael Nutter may be interested in coming back as mayor. Do you have a what do you think of that?
I think that's a great thing. I think, him entering that field, it's a crowded field. He has name recognition. Crime was under control when he was here. People did the job. He knew how to manage, and he was a good administrator. So I think that he would add a lot to that. And it's not going to take a lot of votes to win that race, I don't think. So let's see what happens.
So would you be interested? I mean, would you, I know you guys do get involved in making endorsements. Could you see fit to endorse a guy like Nutter if he got in?
I mean, I'm sure we would have quite extensive conversations, but it's early in the game to put us out there, be able to back one horse. Now, we got to see what they're promising and what they're going to do for the Philadelphia police that are on the street now, and how we're going to get more police into the city.
Are there any declared candidates that have piqued your interest? I know you're not a formal endorsement, but anybody that's interesting to you?
There's a couple out there, but, you got to be careful because they pat you on the back and tell you what you want to hear. And then then you're out the door. And once they get elected, the door is locked. So I think right now we just sit back, we cool our heels, wait a month or two, see who drops out. There's not going to be a discredit of a race come 30 days from now, 45 days. There's going to be some people dropping out, people that thought they were going to get the support that aren't going to get it. People can't raise money. So we're going to see in about 6 weeks who's left standing and then move forward in that direction.
My guess is you're not going to be attending any Helen Gim fundraisers, though.
Yeah, absolutely not. That's one right now that I could say that we would not be endorsing. I don't know. God forbid,
I don't know. Crazy things these days. What do you think of her shot? I mean, she's as whacked out as they get.
As whacked out as she gets, she led the league in votes in city council.
Yes.
So that's very scary. So I think we got to have an all-out anybody but Gim campaign. So let's see where that goes. But you just made my handshake here. I gotta calm down a little bit. So.
All right, I didn't mean to upset your week and to get it started already, John McNesby. We'll have you back. Listen, meantime, join PhillyPD.com if you're thinking about a new career line of work or maybe tip somebody off about it. Join PhillyPD.com. John McNesby, president of FOP Lodge 5 here in town. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Take care, man.
All right, 610-850-0990. Anybody but Gim, he just said.
Ooh.
Anybody but Gim. So he wouldn't really commit to endorsing anybody, except he did say unequivocally, that can't happen. And she's probably the favorite horse right now, wouldn't you have to say?
Yes, yes she is.
Unless Nutter got in. I wonder, you think Nutter could win again?
I'm really not happy with how this field is shaking out. I don't think he could win with her contingent. I don't think they'd break from her, in other words.
Well, progressives don't like him, right? I mean, he's considered too moderate.
Correct.
For progressives, yeah. We have that just unbelievable tape of him saying that you ought to pull your pants up and take the hoodie off in a church pulpit. I mean, that's, can you win progressives when you say things like that? I say tongue-in-cheek, of course, but, I mean, that's, Michael Nutter's like Ronald Reagan in Philadelphia, for heaven's sake, so I don't know whether he could surface again or not, but I never would have imagined, when I first got to town, and it's Michael Nutter and Charles Ramsey, and you look back on that now, and again, that's like in a different era, that's a different time, that's like... what it's become versus what it was. That's stunning. But anyway, that's John McNesby. He wants rid of Gim. He wants rid of people like Krasner. And it seems like the city is increasingly gravitating toward them. And because of people like these, he's got 1,000 to 1,200 officers short on the streets. Crime is certainly not dissipating at all. So I don't know. What do you do? He doesn't think, and I think he's right, it's not going to take too much by way of turnout for somebody to win. It's not like participation. See, that's the thing. Participation in Philadelphia municipal elections is so anemic, sickly low and anemic. So, a real concerted effort to go out there and collect ballots might make a difference. Who knows?
This is Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now with Philadelphia's Morning Answer, here's Chris DeGaulle.
It's pretty funny yesterday. Mike Quick's franchise record for most receiving yards was surpassed. And Merrill in the booth said, yeah, it was, I kind of liked this, his broadcasting buddy kind of sticking up for him. Yeah, yeah, okay, your record was surpassed. But what you did in 16 games, it took Brown 17 to do so. Ray Didinger is our great friend. He's a Hall of Fame sports writer. He's a proud graduate of Temple University, by the way, and it would never bring that up. He's in the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame. He has been covering your Philadelphia Eagles professionally for decades and decades and decades. He's now enjoying his first full year of retirement, but yet he was still kind enough, and he is kind enough every now and again, to come off the bench in the morning and give us his input, because we know he's still watching out there as a fan. And Ray, I thought that was a cool moment yesterday that, you know, Merrill kind of said, yeah, okay, yeah, you got your record, but you still bested him by a game. Good morning.
Hi, Chris. Yeah, that's, and I'm sure Mike totally said, hey, listen, he's got the record, he deserves it. You know, that's,
he did.
That's Mike. But it is true. And Mike Quick was a great player. He really was a great player on a franchise that's had a lot of great receivers. I mean, the Tommy McDonalds, the Harold Carmichaels. There have been a bunch of them. Benny Hawkins. I mean, there's been some great. This team hasn't won a whole ton of championships, but they've had some great receivers. And Mike Quick ranks right at the top. If he hadn't had the injuries that he had, I think there would have been a bust to him in Canton, Ohio, too.
I am really intrigued with the Jalen Hurts story, because the last two losses without him, he comes back, they win, and they win pretty handily. I mean, I wouldn't call it dominant, and he was not exactly dazzling. And in fact, they said his arm was really hurting by the time it was all said and done, his shoulder. So what are we to take from that? Is the suggestion that this team has to have Jalen Hurts or they can't win? I mean, is that the implication here? Because it kind of reads that way a little bit.
I think that's true. I was having a conversation with a guy like a week ago, and he was saying, oh, it's a shame that Jalen Hurts got hurt, because he would have won. He certainly would have won the MVP award. But now that he's missed these two games, you know, he won't be the MVP. And I said, on the contrary, I mean, to me, the last two games prove that he's the MVP. I mean, the Eagles, if you saw the Eagles team with a healthy Hurts and then the Eagles team of the last 2 weeks with Gardner Minshew, I mean, there's no clearer case about, yeah, who's the MVP? It's this guy. I mean, because the Eagles are a totally different team with a healthy Hurts running it. I mean, that was the proof that he's really the MVP. Now, I agree with the man's basic point is, okay, missing those couple games is probably going to cost him the MVP, and it's now going to be Patrick Mahomes, as it should be. But, I mean, if the idea is to give the award but to someone who truly defines the idea, the concept of the most valuable player, well, all you have to do is look at the Eagles with Hurts and the Eagles without Hurts over those weeks, and you say, yeah, that there's your MVP right there. Now, yesterday, it's obvious that they had two thoughts in mind. They had to win this game to get the number one seed. They had to do what they had to do to win this game to get the number one seed. So they obviously knew they could not let Minshew anywhere near the field. So we got to put Hurts out there, but we have to do it in a way that's not going to risk worsening his injury. So that's what they did. I mean, they had him. They took away all the RPO stuff. They took away all the designed runs, the quarterback draws, all the things that he does really well that make him special and make this offense special. And they try to just make him kind of a pocket passer, and it got them through this game. But they need the old Hurts. They need the Hurts of the rest of the season if they're going to get to Arizona and win the Super Bowl.
What's the significance of his injury? I haven't read a lot about it. Do we know? I mean, is this just kind of temporary, or is this kind of a problem for the rest of the season?
I've kind of dropped a cloak over it. But I mean, that's what they've been saying from the beginning, was it's a sprained shoulder, which you can define in a couple of different ways. I mean, I thought when it happened and the way he reacted and the way he looked afterwards, I thought it was a significant injury. And, you know, they have been saying all along, oh, it's a sprain, he'll be fine. But then yesterday you saw the way they played him, and you saw what both Nick Sirianni and Hurts said after the game, about, yeah, he's hurt, you know, and what he was playing through. It's a significant injury. I mean, I think it would not surprise me if after it's all said and done, they tell you it was some degree of a shoulder separation. And you just hope there's not rotator cuff damage too. I heard all the chatter and I saw some of the post game shows after the game yesterday, and everybody was just kind of dismissing his performance yesterday and the way he looked and the way he played with. Well, he was just rusty. You know, it was 2 weeks off. He's just got some rust, and you know, he'll knock that rust off. Now he got to knock that rust off today, and now you know, with a week's rest, he'll be fine. I said, well, there's two different things here. Is he just rusty, or is he hurt? You know, that's the question to me. He didn't look like himself yesterday. Good enough to win the game against the Giants. Okay, fair enough. But did he look like the guy that got you to 13-1? No. And okay, was it rust, or is he really, really injured? And you're just trying to play through that. He got you to the playoffs, but to try and get through the NFC and to go to the Super Bowl and win the Super Bowl, you're going to need Hurts to play like the Hurts that we saw the first 2 months of the season. And the fact of the matter is, if he's really injured, it's going to be very hard to get him back to that level.
Ray Didinger, I have been really curious to know what you have been thinking while watching this DeMar Hamlin episode. We haven't talked, so this is the first time hearing your commentary. So if you've given it elsewhere, I've yet to hear you say what you thought when you saw him drop. And then subsequently how you felt the league handled it that night and then their decisions after to, you know, cancel that game and now some scheduling decisions that they've made. I'm just curious what you think of the whole episode now that we know he's okay, it appears.
Yeah, well, it was horrifying that night. I mean, it was chilling that night to see the way he dropped and to know immediately, no, this is something really serious.
You've covered this game for decades. You've never seen anything like that, right? You've never seen that, I would assume.
No. But I have a little. I had a little personal history with it in that the only player to actually die on the field in an NFL game, which I thought I was seeing again, was a guy named Chuck Hughes in 1971, and I knew Chuck Hughes. At the time he suffered the heart attack that took his life on the field in Detroit, before he was a Detroit Lion, he was a Philadelphia Eagle. And he was on the team when I first started covering them in 1970, when I was a first-year Cub reporter assigned to the Eagles in 1970. Chuck Hughes was at that time a fourth-year veteran receiver. And so I got to know him that summer at that training camp. Now, they traded him before the season started to Detroit, and that was where he was playing for the Lions when he went down. But I got to know him that summer. So when the Chuck Hughes tragedy took place, it was somebody that I knew and liked. I mean, I had gotten to know him. He was just a wonderful guy. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of players, especially veteran players, that went out of their way to be friendly to me that first summer. You know, the 23-year-old rookie reporter up at training camp is not somebody that a whole lot of people flock to say, hey, nice to meet you. But Chuck Hughes was, because he was that kind of person. And so when he went to the Lions, I was probably the last person he talked to before he left town. And, you know, I said, I'm sorry to see you go. And he said, well, listen, this is probably the best thing. You know, the Eagles have got a lot of receivers. I'm not going to get a chance to play here. But the Lions need a receiver, and the Lions, frankly, were a better team than the Eagles at that time. So he said, I think this is probably for the best. So I wished him well, and we didn't speak again. And then the next thing I knew, I saw the images of him being wheeled off the field in Detroit. And so that's all those memories were coming back to me when I saw what was going on with Hamlin. And you know, the way it's been very heartening to me to see the way the league, and I mean this mostly the coaches and the players, the guys on the field, the way they have rallied around him, I think has been, it sort of speaks to what I think is something that I've come to appreciate in my 50-plus years around the NFL is the true fraternity of that those guys represent, the coaches and the players, and the respect that they have for each other. Because they all know the road that they've traveled to get there, and they all know the price that they've paid to get there. And there is, beneath the competition, which is very real and very fierce, there is a mutual respect. Now, that's not universal. I mean, within the NFL, there's that 5% of the guys that are just total blockheads that don't get it. Yeah. You have a guy like Thibodeau, the guy with the Giants who sacks Nick Foles, and while Nick Foles is lying there injured on the field, drops down next to him and starts doing snow angels to celebrate his sack. I mean, a guy like that is just he's just an idiot, and he simply doesn't get it. But the vast majority of guys in the NFL, and you saw it with the way they've rallied around Hamlin, whether they knew him or not, I think sort of speaks to what is truly a fraternity of those players. And I felt good about that part of it. And the fact that the young man is bouncing back and looks good. Now, whether he resumes his football career or not is at this point irrelevant. But the fact of the matter is he will survive. And I think we can all celebrate that.
So, Ray, I don't misunderstand this as vulgar, the question. I'm just being blunt. You mentioned Hugh's death, and if I read correctly, that game went on and he died. Hamlin did not die, and that game was canceled. And I'm just curious, over the decades, what's the difference? Is it social media? Is it the visual? Is it that we all saw that thing and it made it more? Because, I don't mean to sound callous. Even Hamlin, when he came conscious, the first thing he said was, did we win? Because that's what those guys are all thinking. They want to play, right? So that's a really extraordinary thing to cancel a game.
Yeah, it was, but I really don't know that they had much choice. In the case of Chuck Hughes' death, it happened like right at the end of the game. It was like the final minute, and the Lions were in like a hurry-up offense, and Chuck had run a pass route, and he had gone down the field and was trotting back to the huddle, and he just dropped over. And it turned out that he had when they did the autopsy, they found that he had severe hardening of the arteries. He had like the heart of an 80-year-old man.
Wow. Ray, I apologize. We had some sort of technical hiccup for a minute. So had just told us that Hughes and the condition which he was found, you say this is obviously different with Hamlin because we were seeing the visual.
Yes, but I think that the one thing that we really still haven't gotten a straight answer on is, did the NFL actually send out the word that we're going to have a 5-minute warm-up and we're going to resume the game? That has been denied. That the league said that we didn't do that. But the people at ESPN, and certainly when Joe Buck goes on the air and says there's going to be a 5-minute warm-up and then the game's going to be resumed, he didn't make that up. I mean, somebody told him that. So if the league was really thinking in terms of continuing the game, that is horrific. I mean, that they were actually thinking of doing that. What I saw happen, or what I think really happened, was you saw the two head coaches meet. I mean, you saw Zach Taylor, the Bengals coach, go across the field and talk to Sean McDermott, the Bills coach. And you saw them talk, and you saw, them gesturing and talking. And then they shake hands and walk away, and they both wave to their teams, come on, we're going off the field. And I think what happened was that the two coaches just between themselves said, we're not playing. We can't finish this game. After what these guys just saw, we're going to ask them to resume the game and play it? No, we can't do that. I think the two coaches, the two head coaches, had the good sense to shut the game down. And if they did, good for them, because that was the right thing to do.
And so, setting aside whether the league made the right call or not, now the league's handed this situation where there's an incomplete game, and that messes up the schedule going forward for the whole league. And again, not to be insensitive, because we're talking about a man's life, but I mean, from just the practical standpoint of running this league, how would you govern it if it were you and you were Goodell or whoever makes these decisions?
I think that it certainly would have been wrong to try and finish the game.
Yeah.
I can't imagine there's anybody that's going to argue that, no, they should have gone ahead and finished the game. I mean, there's no way you can say that and be correct about it. They couldn't finish the game. Now, Could you reschedule the game? Could you play the game a week later and then, like, push the entire postseason schedule back and take away the – and push everything back a week and then take away the bye week before the Super Bowl? I guess you could have done that. But then you're affecting all the other teams in the league, too. Could you have played – try to make them play on Wednesday and then play again on Sunday? No, I don't think you could do that. I just think it was an extraordinary circumstance that it was just one of those things that, I mean, we had not seen anything like this. Well, Chuck Hughes was set 1971, so we hadn't seen anything like this, approximating this even, since 1971. So I think you just kind of have to acknowledge that it's one of those things. Nobody wanted it. Nobody foresaw it. We just did the best we could under the circumstances. And if the result is that the AFC Championship game has to be played at a neutral site, it's not perfect, but I think it's probably a reasonable compromise given the circumstances.
Yeah. And that's really fundamentally the biggest thing that comes of this, is the AFC Championship game may be played in a neutral site, which, you know, all things being equal, that's not the worst thing in the world, I guess. I mean, unless you're the teams playing, I suppose.
No. And listen, if you wind up with it played, and I'm sure if they can pick a neutral site, they'll pick a good neutral site. I mean, they'll put it either in a dome, or they'll put it in California in a warm weather place where they're going to ensure that you're going to have really good playing conditions. You're going to have ideal playing conditions. And in that respect, it may even be better than playing the game in sub-zero temperature somewhere. You're going to lose the home field advantage, but in terms of a competitive game, at least it'll be equal for both teams. And, you know, when I look at the AFC, I mean, to me, it really does look like it's, and I've felt this for a while, that it's heading towards a Kansas City-Buffalo game. I really do. They, to me, are the two best teams, and I think that they're going to wind up being the two teams that are going to wind up playing in the championship game. And it'll be a heck of a game. I mean, you got two explosive offenses, but two offenses that make just enough mistakes to keep the other team in the game. I think it's going to be a real fun game. I think it's going to be a real shootout, and you know, it's a game with a real rooting interest for Philadelphia, because the Eagles may be the team coming out of the other conference, and you've got two head coaches that are competing over there in Andy Reid and Sean McDermott that the people in Philadelphia know very well. So it's I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a fun postseason. And in Philadelphia, the only question really is, you know, how healthy is Jalen Hurts? Again, Chris, like I said earlier, I don't think it was a matter of rust yesterday. I think he's injured. I think he's playing with a significant injury. And if that's the question, you know, how can the coaches get him back to playing close to the level that he played the first 10, 12 weeks of the season, when the Eagles were clearly the best team in the league, but they were really the best team because they had the best quarterback?
I've been dyspeptic about the idea of a Chiefs-Eagles Super Bowl for the better part of this season. There's a long way to go before we'd get there, but I'm a lifelong Chiefs fan, so I have to give that the edge in rooting. But that would be a tough one to watch.
I've been thinking about that a lot, because I know that you are facing a dilemma there. There's no question about that. But I fully respect the fact that you're a good, honest Chief fan. You come by it honestly, and it's going to be. I think it could be that game. But you know, Chris, there's something with the Buffalo team. You know, I mean, there's.
I know.
You know,
it's magic, that
the
team.
Hamlin thing, and you know, it's a team that's never won a Super Bowl. They've had their hearts broken a million times. Yep. They had their hearts broken in the playoffs by the Chiefs a year ago. Now you have this horrible snowstorm. They had the shooting at the supermarket. Now you have the Hamlin thing. It reminds me very much of what the Saints went through when they won their only Super Bowl coming off Katrina. I mean, sometimes there's a certain karma that takes over, that a team's able to ride that all the way. And the Buffalo team has that. And they've also got enough good players that they could be writing a really wonderful story right here.
I can see that. I agree with you completely. They seem like they may be, I mean, in the worst way, sort of a charmed team. But I completely concur. It'll be fascinating. Ray, thank you for waking up with us this morning and doing this. We always appreciate your voice.
And it's always a pleasure visiting with you, Chris. I'm sure we can talk. If it turns out to be Eagles Chiefs in the Super Bowl, you and I have to revisit this.
I guarantee you're the first guy I call. No doubt about it. Thank you, my man.
Take care, Chris. Bye-bye.
Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
All right, Matt Gaetz was one of the members who ultimately ended up voting present so McCarthy's nomination could move forward and he could become the next Speaker of the House over the weekend. He went on with Mike Emanuel on Fox and talked a little about it, whether it was worth it or not. Take a listen to some of this.
So is it worth it all going 15 rounds to elect a Speaker?
Absolutely. We got concessions that really were being rejected as early as Monday when it comes to being able to read legislation 72 hours before its adoption, individual appropriations bills, and ultimately what we negotiated ensures that we will never again have a circumstance like this omnibus spending legislation, because bills will have to comport to a single subject. There will be germanity requirements on amendments, and so it's going to be an open process, a transparent process. I'm thrilled at where the House of Representatives is today.
You are quoted as saying the construct of these rules concessions functionally turn the speakership into a ceremonial position. Do you mean that?
Well, Speaker McCarthy is our speaker, and long live the speaker. I look forward to working closely with him, but he did agree
right.
to his
a little more of this because we're about out of time. Mike Rogers hates Matt Gaetz, hates him, and at one point, Gaetz held up the 14th round. He didn't vote present. He voted against him, and Rogers lunged at him on the floor. They had to restrain Rogers from it. Emanuel asked him about it.
There was a tense moment late night Friday night when Congressman Mike Rogers, expected to be the next chairman of House Armed Services, confronted you. You guys both serve on the Armed Services Committee. What was that all about, and are you guys going to be able to work together on armed services?
Well, Mike Rogers is going to be a terrific chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and we share a deep commitment to our national defense, to our men and women in uniform. And, of course, in a late-night moment of high drama, people can have moments of frustration. But Mike Rogers and I have a six-year productive working relationship. We're going to work together wonderfully going forward, and I don't think there should be any punishment or reprisal just because he had an animated moment. He has my forgiveness and certainly is someone who's done great things for our national defense and will continue to do those great things.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. That's Gaetz. Now, look, folks, those of you who didn't hear it off the top, those of you who were not a member of the Harum Society, you would have read that I already wrote about this over the weekend. You can go to ChrisStegall.com and subscribe to the Harum Society, because that's where I go when I'm not here. Nothing to sneeze at here, what they managed to achieve. If you came away from this thinking McCarthy wasn't going to be Speaker, you were listening to the wrong people. You certainly didn't hear that from me. These 20 people exacted, and by the way, I want to repeat, Donald Trump was one of the chief cheerleaders of Kevin McCarthy. So these 20 people got some real commitment from him. We'll see if they get it done.
990, The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. 3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.